Well, I think Jackson Brown said it really well there, Don.
Yes.
And
lies in the balance.
Lies in the balance. And it's so appropriate, unfortunately, as an intro to our next guest, who has a new book coming out next week, David Swanson, and the title of the book, War is a Lie. And let me introduce David. He is also the author of the best-selling book, Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, and also an introduction to the 35 Articles of Impeachment and a Case for Prosecuting George W. Bush, published by Farrell House. And he also worked as a newspaper reporter. He holds a master's degree in philosophy from the University of Virginia. He was the communication director for Janice Kucinich, and also did press. He was press secretary as well in Dennis Kucinich's 2004 presidential campaign. He was the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association and 3 years a communications coordinator for ACON. And with that being said, Don, I know you did. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Wonderful introduction.
You have quite a background there, to say the least, and I had seen you the night of the election with Tom Hartman.
Right.
And you had some very, very insightful comments to make. And
David, this is Don Thompson, and I, too, worked for ACORN in New Orleans right before 9/1/101. We have carryover effects of what's going on in our country. Particularly the last election, this off-year election. And I was wanted to, before we got into the war lies, et cetera, to ask you about what you see in relation to what was ACORN and what has become of it and your experience with it.
Yeah, well, I was down there around that time for the referendum to boost the minimum wage in New
Orleans. Exactly,
and
me too.
To do media work and to knock on doors, and I've never had such an experience of, you know, usually no matter how good the cause, you knock on doors, you get 10% of the people to even give you the time of day. You're lucky. I didn't get a single person who said no to anything. It was put the sign in my window, put it in my yard, put it, you know, and of course we won that vote and raised the minimum wage in New Orleans until the courts overturned it at the higher level.
I thought it was Katrina.
and everything after 9/11 that was related to progress for people and the social good and spreading prosperity to more than just the upper 2% went away because it was wartime, which has been the experience of nations around the world for centuries now. That, you know, if the people who aren't getting any of the benefits of your society are getting a little anxious and rowdy, all you need is a war, and you can completely change the topic, which is part of how we got a war against England to start this whole national escapade. But ACORN was a wonderful place to work, and I was, you know, I was the only person. They'd gone almost 40 years without having a full-time communications person, media person.
Wow.
And then they had me for 3 years, and then the job kind of went away again. And I don't think I could have done much to save ACORN had I been there when the right wing scams and the pretense of having gone in as a pimp and a prostitute and all that was put out on Fox News. But I would have liked to be there to go down with the crew to help to try because, you know, by the time they got to Shirley Sherrod, she knew how to respond. And it was not an identical situation, and it was not as easy for ACORN, and nobody at the top of ACORN knew exactly what was happening in each office, and there was already all the discord from them having exposed the scandal of Wade's brother taking money and so forth. But God, the Acorn should have come back hard. I mean, these attacks, just like the propaganda for war or the arguments for dismantling Social Security or anything, at first seems so outrageously absurd that you almost don't want to respond. And yet you have to respond in detail, specifically, hard, immediately, and denounce the lies as lies, not try to not try to look like the reasonable person and put a good face on it, because otherwise you're going down. That's our communication system now.
Yes, yes. Let's continue that theme, though, because it's I say I'm a veteran of domestic wars, and that's related to what you were just talking about, because I was in that one as well as a number of others in local nonviolent demonstrations in the following of the teaching and person of Dr. Martin Luther King. Bob, which one of those do you want to take?
Well, I want to recite a quote from the chapter 2 in the book. And the title of this chapter is Wars Are Not Launched in Defense. And what you have here is creating war propaganda is the world's second oldest profession, and its oldest line is, they started it. Wars have been fought for millennia in defense of the way of life of various states. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, in this book, each chapter I take a general theme of the types of lies that are told to start wars and to keep wars going and to justify wars after the fact. And as you said, chapter two is wars are not fought in defense. And of course, on just about every side of just about every war, there is the claim of defense, even when both sides are aggressors or one side is the clear aggressor. It doesn't matter. Everybody claims to be acting in defense, and they stretch that, of course, to preemptive defense. So we have to go attack them because they're thinking about possibly attacking us. And then, as you cited, the way of life argument, oh, well, we're fighting in defense of our way of life, which has been rhetorically a way to blur the fact that you're not fighting in defense in the legal sense. You know, under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which we put in place in 1928, which banned all war and was ratified 85-1 in our Senate, and under the UN Charter from 1945 that bans war with the exception of defense and with the other, even more dubious, exception of UN Security Council authorization, war is illegal unless fought in actual defense, that is, fighting off an attack on your territory by someone else. And that just doesn't happen. None of the wars that the U.S. has fought have ever been in defense. And, you know, people will point to Pearl Harbor, of course, and Hawaii was not the United States. It was not a state. It was an imperial outpost where we'd overthrown the queen for the sugar plantations. And we spent years and a great deal of effort provoking Japan into attacking it, wanted Japan to attack it as a means to enter the war there and in Europe, and knew they were going to attack it and left the fleet there to be bombed. So you have to go back to wars on Native Americans, where, of course, there's the problem of whose land it really was, or the war of 1812, to have any sort of argument whatsoever for having fought in defense. And even there, it was the United States that declared war in 1812, one main goal of which was to conquer Canada, which was going to be a cakewalk, just like Iraq. I mean, you hear almost identical phrases in the arguments of war proponents going back for millennia through wars by this country and many others.
I like this quote from the next chapter. The chapter 3 is, wars are not waged out of generosity. And the argument is, we will not abandon the Iraqi people. And the quote is, if I break into your house, smash your windows, bust up your furniture, and kill half your family, do I have a moral obligation to stay and spend the night?
Well, it sounds funny when I put it that way, but it's basically the case made by Colin Powell to George W. Bush prior to invading Iraq with this pottery barn analogy. You break it, you own it, and so forth. But it's crazy. If someone invaded our country, you know, we wouldn't think they had a moral obligation to stay until everything was good and well in our country. We would want them to get the hell out immediately and leave us to our fate, regardless of how miserable we might be, how uncertain our future government might be. We would want the foreign occupiers out, just as Iraq and Afghanistan and many other nations have wanted and do want the United States to get out, and that's our first obligation. We talk about staying in Afghanistan because women don't have rights there, ignoring the fact that they don't have rights under U.S. influence, and they don't even have the right to life, in that we are killing a great many of them, and ignoring their own voices. Groups like the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, which says the post-occupation period will be bad, but it will be worse the longer the occupation goes on. So the first demand is to end it. And yet we act as if we are there on behalf of the very people who want us to get out of their country.
With that being said, this something else I wrote down here, with the shock and awe, is designed to include the complete destruction of infrastructure, communication, transportation, food production, and supply, water supply, and so forth. In other words, the illegal imposition of great suffering on an entire population. And that's in Chapter 3, where the title of the chapter is, We are not waging war. It's out of generosity. I mean, that's right. The amazing thing. We're destroying a whole country.
Right. I mean, once we're in Iraq, you started hearing spread democracy and stay for the benefit of the Iraqi people and so forth. You never heard that earlier. And the approach of the initial invasion was openly one of shock and awe, including everything that you cited. This was an effort not to win hearts and minds, but to beat people down so hard there was no resistance left. And that continued to be the military approach, in that we destroyed neighborhoods. We killed at least 1 million people, at least 1.3 million people by most serious calculations, and drove at least 4 million people into the status of refugees, majority of them outside the country. One of the major factors in violence finally dropping somewhat was the absolute devastation and the segregation of religious sects by neighborhood, with walls in between. And that destruction was the policy, even while we were hearing our military spokespeople talk about winning hearts and minds and staying for the benefit of the Iraqi people. And I'm discussing this in the past tense, but it's by no means over. And you can read stories in the news this week of proposals to stay beyond 2011 if the Iraqi people, represented by our puppet government, want us to. And that will be the case made when, you know, whether the treaty is tossed out or the loophole of putting the troops under the State Department rather than the Department of Defense is used, that the argument will be made that the Iraqis want us to stay. Even though you'll recall that the Iraqi parliament accepted this treaty that Bush and Maliki put in place in 2008 without any consultation from our Congress or our people, only on condition that the Iraqi people get to vote it up or down, and they've never been allowed to vote it up or down because everybody knows without question that they would vote it down and say get out now, not 3 years later. And yet we will be told we're staying for the Iraqi people.
Well, we have a limited time, David, but I think that the situation is even worse in relation to Afghanistan. If we haven't learned that Afghanistan is an impossible place to go in, all we have to do is to check Charlie Wilson's War and find out how much the U.S. set up the Taliban and fought the Russians in the 80s. With U.S. tax money, the CIA, the SEALs, everybody else going at them. And it contributed to the fall of the Soviet Union. This is supposed to make us safe for democracy?
Right. We intentionally provoked the Soviet Union into invading. We've been wreaking havoc indirectly or directly in Afghanistan for 30, 40 years. We funded the jihad resistance in Afghanistan, people like bin Laden. And now, you know, the Russian ambassador says we've committed every mistake that the Russians did in Afghanistan, and we've moved on to adding new ones of our own. And I think, I mean, it looks like we're on a track to give Afghanistan its due as the graveyard of empires. I mean, we don't want just to lose another war. We want to destroy our nation and our economy and our reputation and our safety and our moral character in the process. That looks like it's so irresistible to Washington and to NATO to have bases and to have weapons, including the potential of nuclear weapons, in a place like Afghanistan that borders so many critical places in the world. The location is so tempting that they just can't resist destroying themselves to keep this thing going. And yet everybody knows that it's hopeless and it's a matter of time. How many dollars, how many lives before we get out?
Absolutely. Now, as if that is not enough, under the cover in all these Bush and now Obama years is the war in Colombia, which is a civil war, as you know, that's been going on since almost all the way back to World War II, and the U.S. has chosen sides with a corrupt Colombian government, even now that Uribe is out of there. And my wife and I were teaching missionaries in Peru, so we knew a bunch of what was going on in South America. And we have all this airport and other equipment and military presence in Colombia that, if by miracles we stopped our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, we would be ready to launch against Venezuela by way of Colombia. I'd like you to comment on that, because I get very frustrated with talking to people in churches about, don't send your missionary money there. It's a worse situation than you thought.
Well, and the U.S. Backed a failed coup attempt in Venezuela a couple of years back.
Right, and we have a film to show it. The revolution will not be televised.
Yes, absolutely. Good film, and so is Oliver Stone's new film, South of the Border, or something like that title. The United States has military bases and ships and troops in most of the world, in over 175 countries. We have our military. No other country in the world does anything remotely like this, much less describe it as defense. We talk about the Department of Defense and have since 1948. Even peace groups talk about, let's defund defense. If we even, you know, people worried about the deficit, well, let's take some money out of defense. We have to stop that. It has nothing to do with defense. It has to do with taking over other people's countries for the power and the glory and the resources and the wealth. And South America is in our targets, as it has been for many decades. And Venezuela may still be at the top of the list, but the war machine wants wars, you know, and the excuses and the motivations and the needs for the wars are invented for the wars. The desire for the war is what comes first, and that is firmly in place now and has to be undone. And the only reason that we're not in many more countries with many more wars is that we don't yet have the troops or mercenaries to do it. So if we were out of Iraq or Afghanistan, there are a dozen nations around the world that would need to be on high alert, and we have to undo the underpinnings of the war economy and the war mentality that make this the case, or people in places like Colombia do need to be more worried, even as we use the lie that the war is on drugs to destroy acres and acres of their land.
And take over those lands by the rich in Colombia. I want to get one more on the plate, and that's Iran. I hear those old lies that you recount in your book for going into Iran because they're supplying the resistance against us in Iraq and other places, and need to have Israel or the U.S. take care of that.
Well, this is a success story in some ways in that they've been pushing these lies for several years now on the need to attack Iran, and we haven't done it, in part because we haven't had the forces to do it, but in large part because the American people have been so overwhelmingly resistant. They haven't been able to break 10% in support of attacking Iran, and that's gradually changing and inching up, and they're still pushing it. And they've got people like David Broder in the Washington Post a week or two ago promoting the idea that it would be good for our economy to attack Iran, even though wars and the military are the very worst thing for the U.S. Mm-hmm. economy, never mind all of the other arguments against it. So we have to recognize the success we've been having in this regard in public opinion, even though we've been failing miserably in terms of legislative or judicial power. But it's going to take eternal vigilance.
You know, David, unfortunately, we're heading up towards the end of the hour, and we have so much we'd like to talk to you about. Maybe you can come on again next year. Next year is not that far away, and go over some talk a little bit more about these subjects and others that are related to what's going on here in the U.S. and the lies that are being told.
That would be wonderful. You've got a great show, and if I could just say, warisalie.org is the website, and everybody is going to buy the book on Amazon on Monday, the 22nd, and knock George W. Bush out of first place there, and then we'll be able to promote War is a Lie as the number one book on Amazon that bumped George W. Bush's plagiarized.
All right,
we'd love to see that happen. And we're not allowed to mention price here, but I wanted to mention one special offer that you did make.
Uh-huh.
That if somebody buys 10 or more copies, they can get half price with free shipping. And I think this is prerequisite reading for anyone who has an interest in what's going on today, what has gone on for the last 100 years or more. And I think I had seen a film a couple of years ago, No Sir, No Yes Sir, No Sir.
Right.
And I feel this is another prerequisite movie that people should see. So if they see that movie and they read this book, they will be well informed as to why we should turn our attention to peace. And when the next talk of war comes around, we should get more people in the media heard, more voices like yours in the media heard, rather than 1.5% or 3% of the voices of the opponents to war. And I just want to leave with a couple of quotes of people who have read your book and know you well. This is from Norman Solomon. David Swanson is an antidote to the toxins of complacency and evasion. He insists on rousing the sleepwalkers, confronting the deadly prefabricators, and shining a bright light on possibilities for a truly better world. And I did want to read Colonel Ann Wright's quote. While Americans elect leaders whom they trust are honest, truthful, and really care about the kids they send to kill for our country, War is a Lie reveals decades after decade the sordid side of our history, that our elected officials lie us into war with stunning and embarrassing regularity and are little concerned about the harm to innocent civilians, much less to members of our military. That's from Colonel Ann Wright. So, David, keep up the good work, and we really appreciate you being on the show today.
And God bless you and keep you.
You too. My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.